This is Bronwyn Schwagert, licensed therapist and author at the Angry at the Right Things podcast. Instead of controlling our anger, we'll be looking at what causes it in the first place so we can rectify what's dysfunctional in our lives and in the world. Here we go. Hello and happy December, podcast listeners. This is just me, Bronwyn, today. I am going to wing this without my wingman or woman, which is Katie, just because I'm going to give her a little break. And, you know, I have to share her with y'all when we do these podcasts. And I just want her all to myself sometimes so I can talk about like really personal stuff, which I did get to do yesterday, but I wanted to give her a break today. So I'm just going to share. I have so much to say anyway. I want to start with, do you guys remember the show called Whose Line Is It Anyway? Was that like 20 years ago? Maybe early 2000s. I think it was like an improv comedy kind of show. I don't even think I watched it. I just remember really loving the title, Whose Line Is It Anyway? So today, this section is called, of what I'm going to talk about of this podcast, is called Whose Fault Is It Anyway? And it was inspired by Whose Line Is It Anyway? So I don't know if any of you guys read the book by Jeanette McCurdy called I'm Glad My Mom Died. I think it became like a big hit bestseller. And I didn't know who Jeanette was. I just heard from someone else that she was like a child actress and had a stage mom and just wrote kind of a memoir about her life and about her mom. And the title, you know, when you hear that title, I'm Glad My Mom Died, even me as a therapist, I was just like, what a horrible thing to title your book. But then you read the book and you're like, oh, okay, that was not written out of spite by Jeanette. It's just the natural conclusion that any person would draw given who her mom was. And likewise, when I tell people my mom died in May, they immediately respond with, oh, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, no, actually, it's been great. She's finally at peace. And so am I. And people are kind of just, wow, what do I do with that? You know, they don't know how to respond. And honestly, I haven't shared this with anyone, but when my mom died around that first week or so, I kept hearing in my mind the refrain from the song from The Wizard of Oz, ding dong, the witch is dead. You know that refrain? Ding dong, the witch is dead. Da, 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 da. Yeah, I literally heard that in my mind, in my mind's eye. And what is that, you know, to come clean with you guys and to share that makes me sound like a really bad daughter, doesn't it? Just like Jeanette McCurdy sounds like a really bad daughter, titling her book, I'm Glad My Mom Died. But I want to talk about this. Whose fault is it anyway? Whose fault is it when myself or Jeanette McCurdy feel relief when our mothers die? Is it our fault that we felt oppressed and repulsed by our mother's actions and intentions throughout our lives? Or is it their faults? When young people struggle with depression, anxiety, suicidality, or anger issues, they get sent these days to therapy groups where they teach DBT skills. I use the term therapy here very loosely, as most of these young people don't have the chance to actually talk about themselves in these, quote, therapy groups. But they just learn these skills, and the skills are just all kind of emotional regulation, like breathing and imagery where they imagine holding a stop sign in their mind to stop their negative thought, or hold ice cubes to kind of distract themselves from their anger. And I'm at the place now with my practice and seeing what this does to young people, where I believe these DBT skills groups, these quote therapy groups, actually do far more harm than help. Because what all this does is it reinforces the idea to these young people, I'm the problem. If I could just regulate my emotions better, everyone and everything would be okay. Guys, this is the equivalent of institutional gaslighting by the therapeutic and mental health community. This perpetuates the problem, and these youth don't learn that their anger is valid, that their parents are acting in ways that are objectively wrong and hurtful and harmful and dysfunctional. They never learn to channel their anger into healthy boundaries and assertiveness, but rather to dissociate from it and to stuff it down. Now, this can also happen with individual therapists for people of all ages. There's lots and lots of therapists who are using those DBT skills, or even CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, with their clients. And the clients could be any age. And honestly, if you are going to a therapist who is using DBT or CBT skills, it's likely that there is some, at least some, of this happening with you, where you are kind of being gaslit. In other words, you are being trained or conditioned to kind of second guess your anger and second guess yourself. And instead of seeing the other people as problematic, where you're just learning to manage and shapeshift yourself and your thoughts and your behavior, that you're kind of being taught your job is to change you and not the situation. And again, this causes us to dissociate from our anger. Now, you guys know that I believe that anger is God-given. It's not something we should ever dissociate from. Yes, it can be at times problematic when we, especially when we repress it and suppress it and it ends up exploding or it's passive-aggressive. But we need to listen and heed the warning that anger sends us, that something is very amiss and needs to be repaired or changed. So I want to talk more about this when we learn to dissociate from our anger. So I like that word dissociate, because that's really what's happening. I say suppress, and that is kind of synonymous, but dissociate's kind of the new word I'm using these days. So for example, I see a parent as a therapist who is dissociative from their anger, specifically at their young child. And the parent fears that their anger will harm their child in some way. And, you know, usually this parent experienced that themselves as a child, where their own parent was harmful or hurtful with their anger. And so they do not want to repeat that. And they often identify with the child, with their child. They're identifying with their child, and they're wanting to really protect that child from the same thing repeating. And that's a good thing, that they are cognizant of that, that they're aware of that, that they're empathic and they're working on that. However, if they completely dissociate from their anger, they're going the opposite route of what their experience was as a child. And they then become overly lenient with the child. So now they are maybe continuing to co-sleep with the child for far longer than they really wanted to or signed up to do. Maybe they're just not having good boundaries with their child. They're wanting their child to always be happy. They want to shield their child from anger. They don't want their child to be rejecting of them. That's a big one. And so they're just kind of giving in a lot to this child. And, you know, children are very savvy. And the child is learning that they can kind of run the show and call the shots. And so you can imagine now this parent has all this resentment of their child who's now kind of bullying them and kind of, you know, calling the shots. And so there's just all this additional resentment. But again, it's all being suppressed and dissociated from. And then the parent starts to have dreams about a robber or a monster breaking into the house at night and hurting the child. And that's when they seek out therapy. They seek me out. And guess what those dreams are about, you guys? That's their dissociated anger. The dream of their child being hurt is now a manifestation of that parent's dissociated anger. And it's getting to this level of like, it's scary now. But here's the thing. It's not really scary. It's just scary when we dissociate from it. It gets out of hand and it becomes kind of its own entity. It becomes like this monster of its own. And that's what happens. So now it's in this parent's dreams. And it's just demonstrating their own fear of their own anger at the child. But their anger at their child is legit. And so what I will say to that parent when we're meeting for therapy is I'll say, you know, all parents, if we're honest, resent the hell out of our children. That's normal. Like that is totally normal. If we're honest, we humans are very messy creatures. We feel things like love and empathy and anger and even hatred towards the same people all at once. That's normal. We are, you know, on a spectrum here. We don't just feel love or just feel hate. We feel all of the above at most people in our lives. And that's not bad and that's not evil and that's not dangerous. Or I'll say to going back to the youth who are being basically conditioned by the therapeutic institution now that they're the problem and that their anger is problematic and they just need to manage it, I'll say to them, you know, your anger actually isn't the problem and you are not the problem. Your anger is actually just a symptom of a real problem, which is the way your mother is treating you. It is okay to feel outrage and even hatred toward her. Those are normal human feelings. Those are normal human responses to behaviors that are wrong, objectively wrong. So what I just said, that's a lot. If Katie were here, I'd be pausing and I'd be asking her for her thoughts because I don't want to overwhelm you guys. I know I'm an intense person. I've heard that said many, many times. So I want to kind of pause here and just distinguish between feelings and actions. So in Western culture today, we throw around the words love and hate. And they have really come to mean in our culture nothing more than a sentiment, what we feel. So when we say that we love someone, that means like, oh, I'm feeling these warm feelings of, you know, enjoyment in your company. That's what the word love has come to mean. And when we say hate. I hate that person. We're referring just to sentiments. We're just referring to, oh, I feel like really disgusted and I don't want to be around that person. But you know, historically, those words have not been defined by feelings, by sentiments, but rather by action. Love and hate historically haven't been nouns, but they've been verbs. Wait, is that right? Yes, they've been verbs. So really, love and hate throughout history have been used as metrics for our actions. Talk is cheap, guys. We can say, daughter, I just love you so much. You know, that's so easy to say, isn't it? I just love you so much. I've always loved you. But we can treat our daughter as if we despise her by gaslighting her, by dismissing her feelings, by pressuring her to obey us and please us at all costs. Which is more important, what we say or what we do? We can say we love her and we are actively hating her. And vice versa. So we can feel repulsed by someone, disgusted by someone, what we would call hatred. I felt like that with my mother, especially the more I saw her, the more I processed who she really is and was. And in her later years, I felt repulsed by being around her. Those were my feelings. But my actions, I chose to still treat her with respect and dignity whenever I was around her. My father even told me at one point, he's like, you are so kind to her. Yeah, I was. But did I feel like I wanted to be kind? No, no, I didn't. So guys, which one really matters? Our sentiments, how we feel, what we say, or our actions? If we're religious folks, guys, which matters to God? Does he really, when we talk about, you know, God is love, does that mean God feels a sentimentality of love towards us? Or does that mean he acts in ways that are loving despite how he feels? And by the way, feelings are involuntary. We can't control them. We can ignore them. We can dissociate from them, but they're not voluntary. Actions, those we have choice over. And those are the only things we have choice about. So let's now talk about those feelings of hatred and disgust and revulsion. So just like anger, they're there for a reason. They are symptomatic of something else. And there's a good reason for them. So for example, when we are walking down the street and we see roadkill, we feel disgusted. We feel revulsion and we stay away, don't we? Because those feelings warn us. They say, stay away. This is gross. So that's a good thing. Disgust is a good thing. It's not pleasant, but it's good. It's not pleasant to feel it, but it's important to pay attention to and to heed those feelings that are warnings. And learn, danger, stay away. So I was just talking to someone, I forget who it was, and they were telling me like they felt disgust by someone and they were feeling bad for feeling disgusted. And I said, no, that's a good thing that you felt disgusted. You need to pay attention to your feelings of disgust and just be guarded. Just keep your distance. Guys, how many times do we override our feelings and ignore our gut? And then we find out we were right all along later. So feelings are important, even the painful ones, even the really uncomfortable ones, like disgust and hatred. Do they make us bad people? No. But they do warn us to stay away, to have boundaries, and we can choose our actions to still treat people with respect and dignity. Okay, so I want to go ahead and change this this theme a little bit from whose fault is it anyway to the next piece, which is about compulsivity. So Freud, people have told me I'm Freudian, and I guess, you know, I'm Jewish by race. This guy was an amazing Jewish doctor, had so much insight back in the day. Do I think he was right on everything? No. But he really kind of started a foundation that that really gives me personally and a lot of other people a lot of insight about how our brains work. So one of those things was about compulsion and being compulsive. And he termed this phrase called repetition compulsion. And that's basically when a person is stuck. Their brain is kind of stuck in some kind of trauma, and they'll find themselves in situations to repeat that trauma, to kind of work it out and kind of to master it on their own. So I do see this. And in fact, I have seen this in every client I have ever worked with. I wouldn't necessarily call it a repetition compulsion, but it's something like that. It definitely fits. And I myself relate to this, and I want to get into this. So what I see most commonly is that the people I work with and humans, I'll just say humans, when we don't receive like a solidification of feeling like we have earned or won our parents' approval, our parents' recognition, then we will unconsciously try to win that approval or that acknowledgement throughout our lives in other situations, usually with people in authority or people who represent the parent in some way. So that is what I see in, like I said, pretty much everyone, and I relate to it myself. So I'm going to go ahead and just start with my own story, and it's not, my story isn't exactly what I see with a lot of my clients, but it's very similar. So I've mentioned this in past podcasts. When I became about 15 years old, I became pretty and attractive for the first time. You know, those were the 80s. And so mousse became a thing, and my curly hair finally looked curly and not just like a Jufro. I figured out how to do my makeup. By the way, that was realizing I need to stop wearing the blue eyeshadow and the blue eyeliner. And I even at one point wore blue mascara because my eyes were blue. So I thought that is how to accentuate my blue eyes. Yeah, that was bad. And the other thing that was really bad is I hated my freckles, and I hated them so much. And so I found a foundation that was the same pigmentation as my freckles. And so I covered my face with this foundation to try to mask all my freckles. So I did this, I remember sophomore year of high school, I was doing this. And I remember complete strangers at school, and I think some of them were boys too, came up to me and they're like, "Oh my God, Bronwyn, you have a line on your neck right here where your foundation ends, and I can see it." I remember like complete strangers felt compelled to tell me this. That's how bad it was. So did I want to be attractive more than life? Yes, I did. It took a while, but around age 15, 16, I finally became attractive. I learned to forego the foundation. I learned to forego the blue eyeshadow, eyeliner, and mascara. And I stopped using Sun-In to bleach my hair. So my hair wasn't this weird orangish color anymore. And then there was mousse. So I learned the makeup thing and I learned the hair thing, and I got kind of pretty. Anyway, so I became a flirt the minute I was attractive. Not in a sexual way, really, just in a way to win. And the word win here is really important. We'll come back to that. In a way to win the recognition of the cute boys. I wasn't looking for a relationship, honestly. I was looking for some kind of sign that the cute boys were into me. It could be a look in their eye. It could be a request for my phone number or telling their friend, she's cute. Now, ideally, the word delightful or beautiful was really what I was going for, but cute worked. So if I got any of those above experiences, I would go home happy, like a hunter with a successful catch. And the boys, again, would have to be cute or attractive in some way in order for it to count, kind of like a challenge that I would have surmounted. Now, that sounds pretty innocuous, you know, a 15, 16-year-old girl flirting in a non-sexual way just to feel cute and amazing. But here's the thing. It was compulsive, which is the opposite of voluntary and obviously freedom. I didn't feel free. And sometimes it got me into trouble, as you can imagine, like when the boy had a girlfriend and the girlfriend happened to be my friend, because that happened. Or when I had a boyfriend. Oh, yeah, because that happened too. Or when I was married. Yeah, that happened too. Now, I never cheated on my husband, Steve, per se. I mean, I never slept with another man or even had an emotional affair. But did I still objectify good-looking men so I could feel amazing or win them? Yes. Yes, I did. And I deeply regret that. The last time I started to feel this compulsion was actually just a few years ago. And at the time, I was very aware of what was going on, but I still felt very enslaved to this compulsion. I remember riding my bike one day and really contemplating this instinct, this like guttural, primal instinct that I was doing everything I could to override. And all of a sudden, it occurred to me, oh my God, I'm trying to win the admiration of my father. The minute I thought this, I knew with everything in me that it was true. It was like a revelation, a complete epiphany. And that understanding alone gave me freedom. And to this day, that compulsion is completely gone. Some of my clients' compulsions are similar to mine, but the majority of them are slightly different. The majority of their compulsions are to win the approval of the parent by doing things perfectly and successfully, such as getting all A's, going to a great college, or just being perfect and successful in every way. Instead of them needing to win the people they're attracted to, they often want to win their teachers or their bosses. And just like me, no matter how well they perform or how much they, quote, win, they never feel like they've arrived. It's never, ever enough. There is no feeling of satisfaction. And at the end of the day, just like me, no matter how successful their hunt for approval is, it's like slavery versus freedom. It's not free, it's involuntary, and it's compulsive. And it's not fun. So I do an experiential exercise with these clients in which I will have them bring up a childhood memory, a feeling they weren't enough for their parent. So it might be a memory of a time when they heard their parents say something like, you know, if you weren't successful, I don't think I'd love you. Of course, they're not necessarily saying that explicitly, but something to that effect, something where the child heard through what the parent said, like that they're not loved if they're not successful or performing or getting that approval. So they'll come up with a memory of that. And then I will have them just close their eyes and imagine their 8-year-old self. Let's say it's at 8. They'll imagine their 8-year-old self hearing the mom say this thing, right? And I'll say, what did 8-year-old Shauna, what did her face look like when she overheard that? And they'll say, oh, her face looked just sad and disappointed and ashamed. And then I'll have the client imagine their adult self entering into that memory and addressing their 8-year-old self directly and looking at their 8-year-old self and saying, 8-year-old Shauna, I know you felt like you weren't enough for your mother. I know you felt at that moment ashamed, like you were bad, but I'm here now and I see you as you really are. And I'm going to reflect the truth back to you, a true reflection of who you are. And when I look at you, I see all of you. I see the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I find a net good. I see a net good. I accept all of you. I approve of all of you. And that worth and value and preciousness that I see came with you the day you were born, and it will leave with you the day you die. There's nothing you can do to add to it or detract from it. Nothing. And you can relax now because you've got the acceptance and the approval already. You can relax and you're free. You're free to disappoint the hell out of me and everyone else because I'm not going anywhere. I am committed to you. And I will never abandon you because I love you as is. And you know that woman in the background, that woman that you call mother, that woman who looks like an adult? I need you to know that on the inside, sometimes she's just a little toddler, much younger than you are. And I need you to know that when she says things like that, that you're not enough or that you're shameful, she's the problem, not you. And I'm just here and I'm committed to you and I just want to give you a hug right now and win back your trust. And you'll never be alone or abandoned ever again. So that is what I wanted to share about today. And I want everyone listening who struggles with their own compulsion to win the approval of your boss, of your spouse, of whoever, to be free. Free to disappoint the hell out of everyone else. To be true to yourself. That's freedom. And the people who will abandon you because they're disappointed, man, you're better off without those people. You just want the people who are okay with the disappointment. Those are the ones we want. So I want to just give everyone that freedom and that that encouragement today. And thanks for listening. Sorry that Katie wasn't here, but hopefully she'll be here next time. All right. Bye-bye.